All right, here in verses 20 through 23, at this point in time, in the Judah-Tamar affair, Judah and Tamar have engaged in their sexual liaison. Judah has returned back, obviously, to his camping area. Tamar has returned back to her niche. All this is done covertly, obviously, in this respect. And they part ways with Tamar in possession of Judah's signet, ring, cord, and staff, and a promise of payment from Judah of a young male goat for the price of the sexual liaison of having, of being with this supposedly, in his eyes, temple prostitute, which we know better. And here in verses 20 through 23, we see Judah attempting to then pay the promised kid to Tamar. And the first thing that jumps out at our attention is he does not do this personally. But yet he sends his friend Hira, the Adullamite, to cover for him, if you will, to take care of business. And the Adullamite goes into town, and he cannot find her, obviously, for the reasons which we know. And the reason why Judah, the most apparent reason why Judah sends Hira in to do this is because he wants to save face or maintain a certain appearance in regards to his affair associated with pagan idolatry, as he is a member of the covenant family. He is simply in religious reversionism. It doesn't mean in religious reversionism that one necessarily jettison all of which they might have otherwise stood for previously under sound doctrine. So he wants to maintain appearance. The deed was done covertly, and he wants to keep it that way. In verse 20, when Judah sent the kid by his friend the Adullamite to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. That's because they don't know what they're looking for. They think one thing, but the reality is another. The Adullamite does due diligence to try to find her on behalf of his business partner and friend, Judah. In verse 21, and he asked the men of her place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enaim?" And he's informed in 21b, but they said, "There has been no temple prostitute here." And the language is of such that you're left with the impression that temple prostitutes don't hang out there. this type of activity has not been around their area in that regards. So in verse 22, he returns back to report to Judah what he finds out. So he returned to Judah and said, verse 22, "I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here." So the situation as it stands now is this puts Judah in a quandary, in somewhat of a bind. Obviously, he is motivated to pay her the kid to get back his personal possessions, number one. But a major driving force is that he does not want news to be spread around by this temple prostitute that he failed to pay what he promised in this regards, and hence some type of investigation comes up and he's exposed for the religious perversionism that he is involved in this respect. And the fact that she cannot be found forces him, as God is jamming his efforts here, to make another decision in this respect. And again, appearance is the end-all be-all in regards to, if you will, his whole approach to this thing, which verse 23 makes clear. Just pick up point 35, page 31 of your notes here. He makes a decision to forfeit his belongings rather than confront his perversionism otherwise, and states, "Let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock." So 36, now the English laughingstock here is literally the Hebrew buzz, and means to be held in contempt or despised. And we looked at these verses where it's used as such, 2 Kings 19:21, Job 12, verses 5 and 21, Psalm 31, verse 18, and there are other verses likewise. So, laughingstock comes from the fact that derision, held in contempt, often brings around verbal mocking in regards to others around them. But the main thing is he's going to be looked down upon, held in contempt in regards to his situation. And that is that he is this Hebrew that supposedly holds to this religion of their God that does not practice these things and frowns upon pagan idolatry, and he's involved with it. And then on the other end of the coin, he doesn't want news to get back to his family. Obviously, Sheila is still with him in regards to his immediate family, but the covenant family that he is steeped in reversionism to this degree. So 37, by pursuing the matter further, Judah is afraid that he would be held in contempt for his sin by others. So 38, what the student must understand contextually is that Judah's actions are not about an isolated sin here. Isolated sin, we differentiate between isolated sins where you engage in rebound after the fact. You identify your sins, you rebound it, you overrule your sin nature, you move on, etc., versus what we refer to as reversionistic sinning, where one perpetuates the same sin over and over and over without rebound, without trying to battle their sin nature otherwise. And here, this is a one-time affair. Obviously, as despicable as it might be, in the eyes of those around him, a rebound, a confession by Judah would gain him forgiveness by God and he can move on. But that's not the real issue here. Though he obviously, even though we can't document it, probably fails to rebound the situation, at least immediately in this respect. But anyway, what the student must understand that this whole thing is not about this isolated sexual sin of indiscretion, but the fear, point 38 continuing, of being labeled as a religious reversionist or religious hypocrite. Hypocrisy underwrites religious reversionism when it's contrasted compared to sound doctrine. Maybe not to other religions, but to sound doctrine. Religious reversionism is highly hypocritical. That's because of the omission of truth in much that is goes on, the human viewpoint that is otherwise promoted and practiced amongst these types. So 39, to try and entangle his friend Hera into this web of guilt, to make sure Hera gets on the bandwagon with him here in his decision. He uses here the first common plural, the Hebrew verb hayah, we become. It's interesting there in verse 23a, let her keep them, his items of possession, lest we, you and I, Hera, become or be held in contempt. And this is part of the consequences in regards to having relationships and associations with others, is that often you share in regards to things that occur in their lives, not only in a good way, but also in regards to a bad way, a type of cursing by association in that respect. And here he uses this leverage of his friendship and business association with Hera to bring him in support of his decision. So 40, he uses the leverage of their business friendship to implicate Hera. 41, that they are close friends with the business. Hera's reputation is also in danger as being hypocritical. You can probably discuss the differences and the evils of false religion, etc., with those engaged in it. But when you start pointing out that they're hypocrites in regards to all this, then you're at another level. See, nobody that's normal wants to be known as a hypocrite, even though people practice it all the time and seem to be completely, totally numb to the fact that that's what they are. So 42, now what drives Judah in his decision here is pride. Pride is the fuel to maintain his appearance. And that is an important sin to recognize in regards to one's failings in life. As we know, that the sin of pride is documented as the first sin ever committed in regards to God's creation, and that was with Satan when he fell in the third heaven. His sin was a sin of pride. Obviously, it took in the nuances of arrogance, of vanity, and things of this nature, as we know, in regards to the situation. But pride is the self-exaltation of arrogance in one's person. Obviously, our society feeds off of it, sin pride. Obviously, sanctified pride, which you got to understand that certain actions, reactions to things in life, it can be simple on one hand and non-simple on the other, like sex. Sex outside the divine institution of marriage, I don't care who you are or what you are, is a sin. But obviously, within the institution of marriage, it's not a sin. It's completely and totally legitimate. And so it is in regards to many other concepts in regards to our actions in life. But here, we're dealing with sin pride, where one's appearance is more important than the truth of Bible doctrine and one's spirit condition and state before God. And so this drives him. And the religious reversionist is often driven by pride. The pride does not necessarily mean overtly that one looks self-exalting. Pride can come through trying to self-abase one of oneself, to try to look pious and humble. And they're proud in their humility, see. They're proud in the fact that they deny themselves the creature comforts of life. So obviously, you can take pride in many different areas. So 43, he, Judah, would rather forfeit his belongings, than admit and confront his reversionism. He, again Judah, again personifies Judah as a nation. Part of the irony in following the parallel of the storyline along with the narrative here is that the person Judah is a namesake of the tribe of Judah, which inhabits the land of Israel at the first advent. And that picture, symbolically and by type, reveals this parallel between the forefather that gives the land and tribe its namesake and their spiritual condition of himself with the land at the time of the first advent. So, 44, he again personifies Judah as a nation at the first advent, that ran with pride rather than admit their theological malfeasance, their disobedience. Mark 12:38-40, 2 Corinthians 5:12, we saw the Hosea 5:5 verse in that regards, described them as such, being prideful at this point in time in their history. So 45, Judah's rationale now is that at least he attempted to pay his debt. Quote, after all, I sent this kid, but you did not find her. That being the temple prostitute, i.e. also known as Tamar. End quote. So 46, the irony is that Judah's attempted payment is never received by Tamar. There's no indication that she ever got that young male goat. Thus, she got two children out of it. So 47, God jams Judah's efforts here every step of the way. Obviously, all this frustration is designed to for him to check himself, to check up in regards to the direction and path that he's going. God does that quite often, but the stubbornness of the STA and often the human viewpoint blindness that people fly under in that regards, they miss all these aspects of God trying to get them to wake up and see the error of their way. See. And all this you would think would make one to sit back and think about the situation a little deeper than the superficial STA trend here being of a sexual nature otherwise brought upon himself. So 48, now the kid personifies Judah's attempt to pay with a pagan symbolism of idolatry. That's the narrative. As we brought out, a young male goat had value in pagan idolatry because it is used in certain sacrifices, fertility rites. That fits with a temple prostitute. Oh yeah, I'll take one of those in payment. Additional value to them in that respect. But on the other end of the coin, the kid could be represented in two different ways. That way, and then obviously it's used as a sacrifice of the sin offering under the Mosaic law, and as it would be practiced even at this point in time, probably in history, by these Old Testament saints in the age of Israel in transition period. So that's point 49. This in contrast to the symbolism and the law that portrays the sacrifice for the sins of men. Here is participation in this whole ordeal. Represents association between pagan idolatry and Judah's religious reversionism, otherwise reflected in Operation Tamar. He's holding hands with the cosmos. He's holding hands with a negative reversionist in and of himself. He's tied his life in association with it. And it reflects his own spiritual dereliction, his own spiritual disobedience in regards to his life. That's the trouble in regards to religious reversionism, is that even though one may incorporate parts of the truth, they also incorporate a human viewpoint and ideologies that would otherwise imitate and follow pagan idolatry in some form or fashion. So 51, Hera is an accomplice after the fact. This is the final points here that we're finishing up. Illustrating the cohesiveness of negative volition between reversionist believers and their counterpart unbelievers. A believer can act just like an unbeliever in all aspects of life. The only thing that differentiates the two is one's a believer and the other's not. That's where a lot of Christians, they grossly misunderstand in regards to the reality of living the Christian life. They think, oh, because one gets saved, it automatically, ipso facto, they physically are, and mentally and spiritually, everything changes all overnight experientially for them. Now, they're going to be a better person. And that comes with the territory. Not necessarily. Is that true? That depends upon whether or not the individual will plug in after saving faith with the rebound and maturity adjustment to the justice of God. And even then, as we have case in point, validation, an example over and over already in the book of Genesis, believers still fail miserably in regards to sin in a life. Or they can. It doesn't have to be that way, but that's the reality. See, we don't sponsor sinning. We don't encourage it. But the reality is, it's part of life as a believer. You name a sin that an unbeliever get in, you can probably find an example somewhere of a believer engaging in the same sin. And no, the believer doesn't lose their salvation over it. Of all these that we see engaged in certain sins, believers like that, as examples in Old Testament, no place can you see or find where it says they lost their salvation. So, the tandem friendship here of negative volition, non-believer, with the believer Judah represents the correlation of approach in life by one believer who is otherwise, at this point in time, negative to doctrine and steeped in religious reversionism, running under his SGA. So Hera tends to shadow him. That's what I mean after the fact. 52, Hera, quote, did not find her, end quote, because what he was really looking for was positive volition, that desired the fulfillment of the doctrinal promise of the Levirate law, not a pagan whore. Again, religious version, any most perversionisms, whether it's religious or not, causes a certain blindness in one's life. And one does not use good, sound, rational judgment in regards to the decisions that they make. And you have negative volition here looking for negative volition, but on the other end of the coin, that's not what is really there and available. What is there is positive volition that is being and has been, through the example here of Tamar, revealed in her actions. Again, these things are subtle, but the reality is there. When you put all the pieces of the puzzle together, you see it. So 53, God kept hidden his object of search because the search was driven by negative volition and the STA rather than the truth of the matter. Kept hidden through their blindness, even though the reality was right in front of Judah, but he was deceived. See? And that is part of the judgment of negative volition. And that is the truth, the reality. The truth is reality of our life. The big religion today, even among many religious types, the big religion today is science being the Bible. The problem is they dismiss and omit God and his intercession in the affairs of mankind otherwise. See? You know, all this big pompous attitudes and proclamations in regards to science. Alright. You look at science, you look at the history of science, and they don't have really that good a reputation. How many years did they teach that the world was flat? And religious people got involved and would persecute people for taking issue with it. Nothing new under the sun. Matthew 11, 25 through 26. The judgment against negative volition is that God keeps the truth from them. That's part of the judgment. You don't want to pursue Bible doctrine. You don't want to pursue God's plan for your life. Well, then fine. The judgment is you stay ignorant. You stay idiot. You stay fool. You stay blind. However you want to put it. This is a prayer of Jesus. This goes right in the face of what you see the fundies and how they would pray otherwise for other people. God force them to see the truth. You know, shove it down their throats. I mean, this is the type of fundy mentality, at least the kind I came out of. This isn't the way Jesus prays. At that time, Jesus responded and said, verse 25, I praise you, O Father. Obviously, in the protocol of prayer, we always address God the Father. You pray in fellowship. You address God the Father. This is the way you teach your children to pray. They don't pray to Jesus. You pray to God the Father. He's the architect of the plan. He is the ultimate authority of the Godhead. Jesus Christ is the executioner of it. You pray in His name. It's through His means, the instrument of His person, that we're able to address God the Father. in his role as the ultimate authority, the Godhead in creation. So we follow Jesus' example. I praise you, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you did hide these things as Bible doctrine, from the wise and intelligent. That's people who are otherwise mentally and intellectually exceptional in regards to perceiving and understand the things of the world. In its mathematical, scientific, concrete sense. People with doctor's degrees, sometimes several titles of doctors behind their titles and all the academia that they pursue. And men, many of them are many geniuses. I mean, this Elon Musk throwing all these satellites up there in orbit. I mean, this guy has got a lot on the ball mentally. But where is he at spiritually? What does he know in regards to doctrine? See? And Jesus' prayer here praises God for keeping hid from these types because they operate under intellectual arrogance. See, they operate with intellectual pride. And that's what you find in regards to a lot of people with a really high IQ sometimes. Not always. But that whole sense of being better than others. And did reveal them to babes, those who are innocent. Babes is the wise and intelligent looks at negative volition in the world, who otherwise may be driving the world with respect to the technology and physical accoutrements of the world, etc., etc., inventions, things of this nature. Philosophers, mathematicians, the Einsteins, as we would say. But you come down to the Bible, come down to spiritual realities, they're just as stupid as the one that is otherwise mentally handicapped in that regard, or challenged, whatever the words I'm supposed to use anymore. I don't know. And quite frankly, I really don't care. All that we've seen come down the pike, just to stay on this subject for a second, in regards to terminology and not using these certain terms, you know, retarded, etc. All this is leading to exactly what we have today, and that's a squelch of our freedom of speech and opinions and using words that we like to use to express ourselves. That's what it's all boiled down to. And people, you know, oh, I think that's right, you know, you need to be sensitive. Whatever. So his prayer is to give God praise for judging negative volition with the blindness of not knowing the truth. That is a perk of being in Bible class, being in fellowship, learning Bible doctrine that the rest of the world does not have. Obviously, those who engage in it and will indulge themselves otherwise to that degree, obviously, yes, they get blessed. But the world in general is blind. Verse 26, yes, Father, for thus it was well-pleasing in your sight. God determined in eternity past, in addressing the issue of negative volition that he knew would exist among mankind, the free will, the freedom to choose for or against God, that part of that judgment is that those who reject the truth will be blind to it. Well, it makes sense to me. Luke 10:21. The same parallel verse. Here 21, at that very time, he, that's Christ, rejoiced greatly in the Holy Spirit. Jesus Christ, in his humanity, was given the Spirit without measure. And he rejoiced greatly. I mean, like this is enough to make the hair come up on the back of your head if you had any. I mean, the exhilaration. You see this emotional exhilaration in regard to coming to grips with this fact of his prayer. I praise you, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you did hide these things from the wise and intelligent. From the idiots who think that they want to rule the world and can rule the world and then they know better than the rest of us dummies. See? And did reveal them to babes. Babes, again, is technical for positive volition. Positive volition, one characteristic of positive volition is their openness and innocence before God. And their trust that they put in God. Just like an infant or a baby puts their trust in a parent. See? Yes, Father, for thus it was well pleasing in your sight. So we've seen, obviously, with Judah and the example of his religious reversionism here going through this, his lack of discernment, his lack of judgment in regards to circumstances, situations at hand. And this is because he is avoiding the truth, if not outright rejecting it. So, 54, Hira and Judah collectively represent religious reversionism, both as an unbeliever and believer seeking something that God otherwise has kept hid. Negative person, generally speaking, makes their evaluations and decisions based on the physical, based on appearance, and the physical things of life, rather than that which really binds people together, the closest that one can ever have in regard to any relationship, and that is a spiritual bind. Even in the Thundi world, you see that to be true. Marry somebody in your own denomination so you have a likeness of standards and policy that you can follow in regards to your lives. But even more so when both partners are on sound doctrine. Because it is the doctrine that determines the decisions ultimately that should be made and are made by the adjusted couples. In regards to their life, no matter what stumbles they may have along the way. We have a common ground of counsel between us. You don't have to go pay $150 an hour for a counselor. I don't know, churches often provide counseling for people. Well, you want counseling around here, you come to Bible class. That's it. If doctrine doesn't give you your counsel, if doctrine doesn't answer your questions, then we have nothing else to offer you, generally speaking. So, putting these two guys together in this capacity, we see how Moses envelops the whole principle of false teaching, of false doctrine, of religious reversionism, and that they're compatible together, just like Judah getting in bed with Tamar, who is disguising herself as a religious reversionist herself, as a temple prostitute, shows the religious reversionist getting in bed with, the idolatrous world. Understand, idols are not necessarily restricted to a graven image. The New Testament makes it very clear. We create things in life that become our idols. Greed can be an idol. Money can be an idol. Relationships can be idols. Anything of a viewpoint of embracing that goes over and beyond God becomes an idol. 55, their unwillingness to come clean as to the affair forfeits the value otherwise symbolically portrayed by the kid having the rights to exonerate, symbolizing the ring, cord, and staff. So here at this point, I'm putting together the symbolism of all the things that we see projected here, and the fact that there is no repentance, no change of mind. Any true significance in regard to the symbolism of the kid as a sacrifice for sins becomes a moot point in this respect. And in regards to the sovereign forgiveness by the king and ruling shepherd and continued guidance and direction in regards to life, all that is forfeited, basically. See? To get them out of the dilemma. The symbolism of these things are rejected in the face of their pursuit. Verse 56, and so it is for prophetic Judah, that being Israel, as they will forfeit their king shepherd and run under pride for some 2,000 years, allowing the church, the hidden church, to ultimately be revealed for her righteousness, which comes up now in verse 26. See, the church is hidden to a mainline Judaism still today. They recognize our religion. They recognize that we embrace the person that they killed, that being the person of Jesus. But they still deny us in regards to being a right religion and our association with God otherwise. And we were hidden to them in regards to what we were going to be ultimately as a church. But eventually, a remnant will open their eyes in Israel. And as a nation, they will come to grips and they'll look back in time and they'll go, oh crap, they did it right. They embraced our king that we killed. And that's going to definitely be an emotional situation for the nation when they come to that realization. All right. That ends those verses. Now in verses 24 through 26, we have Tamar's condemnation, defense, and vindication, all embedded in these verses. So, as we know, Moses has told us ahead of time that Tamar became pregnant off this one sexual affair. One affair. Talking about God getting you. Go out and you do it one time, and she gets pregnant. Well, that can't be hid forever. So verse 24. Now, looking at the Hebrew here, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed. You have the wow consecutive, followed with the cow and perfect third match and singular or verb hayah, and it came to pass, came about. And now is about is fine. Then you have the preposition kaf, followed with the preposition men. In Hebrew, literally it's after more than. So about 3 months, doesn't say short of 3 months. In the Hebrew, it says 3 months at least. So after more than 3 months, obviously not much longer than that. And then our 3 months, you have the adjective feminine singular construct, shalosh, S-H-A-L-A-S-H, our number 3, then our noun for months, translated months here, common masculine plural absolute, Kodesh. C-H-O-D-E-S-H, literally new moons, hence month. Israel ran on a lunar month. A lunar year, we look at a solar year. That's how we divide time today. That Judah was informed, you had the wow consecutive, followed with the hafal form of the imperfect verb, third masculine singular, hafal being causative, passive, nagad, to be informed, to have been made known, it was caused to have been made known, N-A-G-A-D, to Judah, preposition on it, followed proper noun. And what is informed? Preposition lama with the verb cal infinitive, construct amar, was made known to inform him, to pass the information along, amar. And this is what he was informed. This is how it was put to him. Your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot. And behold, she is also with child by harlotry. You have first the verb to play the harlot. It's a cow, perfect, third feminine singular, a verb, zana, Z-A-N-A-H. She played the harlot. She prostituted herself. Obviously committed illicit sexual intercourse. The same as chapter 34, 31, in chapter, and in chapter 38, our chapter, verse 15. The one doing so, it's a proper noun, Tamar, T-A-M-A-R. And then daughter-in-law, your daughter-in-law, is the common feminine singular noun constructed with the second masculine singular suffix, Kala, K-A-L-L-A-H. That can also be translated, as we saw, wife, bride. Also, let's see. Okay. The series of words here in the Hebrew, first you have and also, wow conjunction with the conjunction gam, G-A-M, followed with then with the interjectory particle, behold, in the English, and behold, she is also, is how it is put out in the English. Our interjectory particle is henna, H-I-N-N-E-H. She is with child, is the adjective, feminine singular absolute, our word hara, to be pregnant, H-A-R-A-H. And then you have the preposition lamed, by, and harlotry is actually the common masculine plural of the noun in the absolute, zenunim, Z-E-N-U-N-I-Y-M, from our word zana, the first word used. And it's literally for playing harlotries in the plural. So Judah finds out, and his next action is, then Judah said, bring her out, let her be burned. That'd go over real good today, wouldn't it? It will eventually in our country. Wow, consecutive, plus our verb, amar, A-M-A-R, cal imperfect, third masculine singular, and he said, proper noun, Judah, to bring her out, to obviously remove her from her premises, and bring her to the public eye as they will watch this occur. Public executions used to be common. It's used as a deterrent for other people to think about doing the same stupid stuff in their life. Of course, we don't do that anymore. But anyway, to cause out is your hyphal imperative, masculine plural, third feminine singular suffix, yatsa, yatsa, and vowel conjunction. Let her be burned is a adjusive form of the force of the nifal verb, imperfect third feminine singular, sharaf. You saw it back in chapter 11, verse 3. To burn, sharaph. Means of execution, capital punishment. All right, well, let's take our break and we'll pick this up, second session.